Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Glad to be with you. Thank you, Mr. Griffin. Appreciate that message today. It was a great message. Nothing could touch me. I like that. That's a very helpful, great message for our Sabbath and for our lives, too, as well. Well, I wanted to just give you just a brief update. You know, we're in the new fiscal year, which began July 1st. And the Council of Elders approved $100,000 for print advertising this year. So we're rolling that out. We did some testing of some ads this time last year. We tested six these coupon ads that go in Sunday newspapers. And we've selected the top two to be used in this rollout because they received the highest response. And we do a lot of testing when it comes to print media. And so in October, we're going to roll out to about 30 million homes throughout the country. And then in January and February, we're going to do the same thing with one ad that's all about angels, the booklet that we advertise, and the other one is about the book of Revelation. So those two really got the greatest response, so we'll see what happens. And I thought I'd just give you a little thumbnail sketch of what's going to be happening. So we're working with agent out of New York, and they have all the contacts, it makes it really easy for us. And our cost is just, we've driven the cost down. It costs us $1 per 1,000 ads. Can you imagine that? That's unheard of. So that's a real blessing. We are what we are buying is what they call remnant space that's left, that's not sold. Because they print these ads, and it's a huge thing. It goes every week in all these newspapers. So we were able to arrange to have this done. And they can't guarantee the exact number that we'll be in, but it'll be around 30 million per time. So anyway, that's pretty good news, and we'll see what happens with that. I have a PowerPoint today, but you notice you don't have a handout, right? You don't have a handout? Well, you're going to get it next time. See, I've got two parts, so you have to show up next time for this handout. And because I don't have as many scriptures that we're going to be dealing with today, I have a number of them, but the second part when I give the second part of the message, there'll be more, and then that will include all the scriptures from today on that same handout. So you'll get it all, but you got to be here for that. So. Anyway, in August 1978, I had the opportunity to participate in a 10-day canoe trip with several others. I was a camp counselor that year, and after camp, we had all the counselors and other staff that wanted to go. We had about a dozen people that wanted to take this trip. It was a canoe trip to the Boundary Waters Wilderness Area region up between Canada and the United States. And in fact, that Boundary Waters trip is going on right now with United Church of God members and administrators. And Frank Dunkel, of course, he's the leader. And I understand there's been no communication with them, so we don't know what's happened to them, if they're all lost a lot of weight because they haven't had anything to eat, what kind of weather they've had, anything. So anyway, but I guess tomorrow's the last day, and I'm sure they had a great time. Mr. Ledbetter went on that trip, if you remember last year, and he said it was very interesting, especially swatting all those mosquitoes, you know. So, but anyway, this is open to young people from 18 to 30. I thought I'd just give you a little update on what's going on with our the current plan and program. And it's great for young people to do this. I know some of the home office staff young people are going up there, and it's a great opportunity to learn outdoor leadership skills and be prepared for personal growth. When you are doing these kind of things, you learn a lot about yourself, and you learn a lot about other people, because you're in tight quarters quite a bit. So, but anyway, let me go back to where I was. So this trip was terrific. It was really wonderful. This area, the Boundary Waters area, is over 1 million acres, and it has 1,100 lakes and hundreds of streams and rivers, and it's located just west of Lake Superior. As you can see on that little map there, it's kind of hard to see that, but over 40 years ago, this was set aside to preserve the primitive wilderness. And with a few, very few exceptions, this area has no motorized traffic, no motorized equipment that's allowed in that area, which is interesting. So you can't take a motorized canoe in there. So you got to be have built up your arm strength, because you're doing this all day long, paddling. So as the 12 of us paddled our canoes from lake to lake during that very memorable trip, and I still remember many things about it, it was just beautiful, serene, very pristine and gorgeous territory. And there's our camp, our canoes. No, that wasn't, I just got that picture. But you can just see how beautiful the area there is. And that's an actual picture of one of the lakes there. So at night we slept out under the stars, the open sky. And it was marvelous. It was beautiful. It was just a wonderful scenery to see that. I mean, to see the skies like that, the stars twinkling brightly, the Milky Way. I've never seen it so beautiful in all my life. Horizon to horizon, it was just that way. And so it was brilliant. I mean, there was no interference from or confliction with light from the city. It was very far away from any city. And I wasn't used to that. I was in California, went to Ambassador College there, lived in a big city most of my life. To see this, it was just stunning. So young people, if you get a chance, if you have the opportunity to do this, I would jump at it. It would really be a wonderful thing if you could do that. Again, seeing that starry sky, that pamphlet, you could say, you know, and you saw the shooting stars that were going by. I mean, the stars were there, and then shooting stars. I'd never seen so many meteors shooting by in all different directions. And that's what I want to talk to you about today. Meteors and other celestial objects have much to do with this message. It's entitled Cosmic Turbulence in End Time Bible Prophecy, Part 1. And this is sort of a follow-up message to the one I gave a little over a year ago about earthquakes in End Time Bible Prophecy. And this is a very important message today. I hope you'll understand, see it, and see what it's about. How much do we really think about Earth, what's happening above Earth's atmosphere? How much do we really think about it? Probably very little, since it doesn't have much to do with our daily life, does it? In fact, when we look up into the night sky, what do we see? Don't we observe stability and peace? Isn't it very tranquil? You look up into the sky like that. Isn't it rather predictable in many ways? Now, we certainly realize that climate here on the Earth and weather conditions are in constant flux. We know that. That's no surprise. We all have all the rain and the wind, and you know, we just had the heat and everything else just recently. And it gets very violently stormy from time to time as well. But that's not what we experience from the cosmos, is it? Humans intrinsically dislike chaos. We don't like volatility or turbulence. We like certainty, don't we? We like steadiness, consistency. That's what we like as human beings. And isn't that what we observe in the heavens when we look up into the night sky above Earth's atmosphere? And since outer space appears so calm and so stable, many people have no particular really interest in it. They don't pay much attention to it. Despite that, though, there are very important reasons why we ought to know much more about what takes place above our heads in outer space, in the cosmos. This is because Bible prophecy tells us what will happen there in the time leading up to Jesus Christ's second coming, and it's going to directly affect our lives and the lives of every human being on the face of this earth. Beyond that, it's important for us to understand prophecy because over a quarter of the Bible is prophecy, about a quarter, and about 90% of it has not yet been fulfilled. That's an interesting statistic. Furthermore, since Jesus Christ will return to earth, he expects that his disciples will be spiritually ready for him when that day arrives. Very important. Luke 21, verse 34. You don't need to go there, but it does tell us that. This is because he wants us to be ready, because we ought to be studying the scriptures. We ought to be studying and grasping Bible prophecy, so we're better able to understand what God is doing. That knowing that he is in control, perfect control, and he's guiding history continually. So as we strive for our reward in the kingdom of God, we need to have that confidence. We need to have courage. We need to be motivated to obey God unswervingly and draw closer to him continually. Very important. But we need to know what he tells us in the scriptures. Bible prophecy is part of that. We need to understand that. So future events, prophetic events, are going to dumbfound people in this world. They're going to shock the socks off of them. Don't want to use a particular phrase today. It's going to frighten most people. But he tells you and me something here in Luke 21, verse 36. He says, "Watch therefore and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things," meaning those dramatic events that he prophesies, "that will come to pass, will stand before the Son of Man." So we need to know what those events are. We need to understand that. So God wants you and me to fully comprehend what end time Bible prophecy declares about, so that we remain spiritually strong and faithful toward him, no matter what we see happening in the skies above. The physical cosmos is quiet right now, but it's going to turn very turbulent in the future. The Bible teaches us that just prior to and immediately following, before Jesus Christ returns and immediately following his second coming, these events will take place. So again, I think it's very important that we spend some time on the physical. That's why I'm taking a little more time during this sermon today to talk about what's happening in the cosmos before we move on to the spiritual, because we need to know what's happening so that we can react properly to it. Let's first consider some scientific background about asteroids, meteoroids, and the asteroid belt from the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. These are statistics I'm going to give you and information. It's from NASA and also the California Institute of Technology. You've heard of Caltech as well. These are statistics I'm going to tell you about here. Asteroids are rocky objects orbiting within our solar system, but are too small to be considered planets. Astronomers have hypothesized that they are fragments from what they feel is leftover fragments from the building of the solar system. That's what they believe. They think that. Unlike planets, which have a consistent spherical form, asteroids are often shaped irregularly, and they're peppered with craters from impacts with other asteroids. While a majority of the asteroids orbiting the sun are called what's called the asteroid belt. These are located between the planet Mars and Jupiter, and some asteroids cross the Earth's orbit, as you can see in this little map here. See the asteroid belt? Did you ever imagine how great, how widespread that is? The asteroid belt is estimated to contain between 1 to 2 million asteroids larger than 1/2 mile in diameter. And there are millions of smaller asteroids as well. Asteroids range in size from the largest, named Vesta. This is actual picture here of Vesta, which is about 329 miles in diameter. That's the distance between Knoxville and Indianapolis. That's a huge asteroid. And there are smaller bodies as well that are about 33 feet in diameter. That's about the smallest asteroid. With millions of asteroids orbiting around the sun, it's inevitable that they will collide with each other from time to time. See that picture? That's pretty dramatic there. Sometimes these impacts are so powerful that they knock these objects out of the asteroid belt right into open space, and they can be placed, therefore, on a collision course with our Earth. That would not be fun. It would ruin your day if that happened, you know. In an extreme example of an asteroid impact on Earth, some scientists theorize that the extinction of the dinosaurs about 66 million years ago resulted from a 6-mile diameter asteroid that crashed into Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. That asteroid created the Chicxulub impact crater, which various scientists believe is the third largest in the world out of 128 known craters today. Another case in point is a large rock asteroid from outer space created the Barringer meteor crater. How many of you have seen the Barringer meteor crater? Been out west? Nobody has. I want to go there someday and see that.
It's not in Arizona.
It's yeah, I believe so, near Flagstaff. Okay, that might have been it, yeah. Well, about 50,000 years ago, according to NASA, about a 160-foot diameter, 300,000-ton nickel-iron asteroid traveling at about 28,000 miles per hour impacted the area, again, that right there near Flagstaff, slamming into the ground with the energy of 20 million tons of TNT, 175 million tons of rock were blasted out of the ground. And it created that nearly mile-wide, 570-foot deep crater. Now, another example of a closer one to where we live here, where we are right now, is in Middlesboro, Kentucky. That has a rare distinction of being nestled right there in a 3-mile-wide zone created by a 1,500-foot diameter asteroid that smashed into the area about 300 million years ago. Anybody around at that time? I don't think so. My mother-in-law has been over in the nursing home nearby there, and Norma's sister is living there right now. And it's amazing. You're coming down from Tennessee or from outside in Kentucky, and you get into this area, it's as flat as a pancake. It reminded me of Wisconsin, you know, where I'm from, you know. Everything's just flat, mostly. But it's like, wow, this is incredible to see this. So that's very close to us. In addition, the Serpent Mound Impact Crater, located in the Adams, Highland, Pike, Tri-County area in southern Ohio, which is 70 miles east of, due east of Cincinnati on State Route 32, if you're ever heading down that way. And I told my daughter about this, and she said, "Dad, we got to go to see that, you know." So someday maybe we'll do that with the kids. It'd be a great scientific project, I think, you know. But anyway, that crater is about 9 miles in diameter. It was formed over 250 million years ago by the impact of an asteroid weighing about 2 billion tons, which traveled about 54,000 miles per hour upon impact. How they know these things, I don't know. But this is all scientific discovery that has been obtained over the years. Now let's return to this discussion of asteroids in space. As they collide in their asteroid belt, fragments break off, as I mentioned earlier. These smaller rocks are known as meteoroids. Not asteroids, but meteoroids. They're the smaller version of asteroids. They can be as small as a grain of sand to about 3 feet in diameter. As these meteorites orbit the sun, they also have the possibility of entering Earth's atmosphere, just like the asteroids do. When meteoroids and asteroids do enter Earth's atmosphere, they are then called meteors. When they enter the atmosphere, they're called meteors at that time, whether they're a meteoroid or an asteroid. They become a meteor when they enter the atmosphere. That's because there's light that's being emitted from them as they're burning up. Now, on a side note, you've seen this term meteorology, right? It describes weather forecasting today. Weather forecasting, weather conditions, and all that. However, in the mid-1800s, it was believed that meteors were only an atmospheric condition. They didn't understand what we know today. Since that time, the astronomical nature of meteors has become widely recognized. And so the study of meteors is actually related to the study of astronomy, the study of celestial objects. Nevertheless, here we go. We still have this term meteorology applied to climate conditions, which is, you know, go figure. How is that? I guess maybe it's so ingrained in our society that people don't want to change the name, you know. So anyway, it should be something different than meteorology, you know.
Weatherology,
climatology. That probably has something to do with global warming and everything else, right? If that even exists. Now, another question. How many meteors enter Earth's atmosphere? Look at that. 25 million meteors enter the atmosphere every day. Isn't that incredible to think about? This is from NASA as well. Although this is from the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C. I think I was surprised by that. I could not believe the number. Every day, then you multiply that by 365 days, and the Earth is being pummeled by meteors continually. We just don't even know it. It seems so stable up there, doesn't it? However, according to space.com, 90 to 95% of these objects burn up as they plunge toward the Earth, and you know how fast they're traveling? Between 25,000 and 160,000 miles per hour. That's an amazing thing. Also, very interesting, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena estimate that 100 tons of sand-sized particles and dust settle to Earth's surface each day. 100 tons, this is each day, 100 times tons is about the weight of one blue whale, or 67 2019 Volkswagen Beetles. They're all hitting the Earth. I mean, they're coming through our atmosphere. When you multiply that by 365 days, that's a large quantity of sand and dust that's coming from outer space that's settling on the Earth. I wonder if some of that stardust is what you wipe off your coffee table and other furniture in your home every day. Ever think about that? I wonder, where'd all this dust come from? And we have, Linda and I have a joke. It says, she says, I'm going to clean the tables. And I said, well, we'll just do it whether we need to or not. But we always have to need to, you know. Everybody knows that, you know. So anyway, those fragments of rock are called meteorites. After they hit the Earth, that's the only time they're called meteorites. It's after they reach Earth's surface. One might think that a meteorite weighing, for example, less than a pound wouldn't do much damage. However, since it's traveling at such a high rate of speed, it could easily penetrate the roof of a house. And these are actual pictures of where a meteorite did do that very thing. So I hope you have good, strong roofs up there right now. No, it's not going to stop a meteorite traveling at 160,000 miles an hour, you know. So while there is, in fact, an extremely low risk of a meteorite impacting a structure or a person, there is a great concern, however, by the shockwave that's generated by asteroids or large meteors when they break apart in Earth's atmosphere. And that's an actual picture of a meteor breaking up in Earth's atmosphere. For example, according to an article on space.com entitled Chelyabinsk Meteor, a wake-up call to Earth. This is an article written by Elizabeth Howell on January 9th, 2019, regarding the meteor that affected the area around Chelyabinsk, Russia. And this is what she wrote, and I quote, "The Chelyabinsk meteor was a small asteroid about the size of a six-story building that broke up over the city of Chelyabinsk, Russia on February 15th, 2013. The blast was stronger than a nuclear explosion, triggering detections from monitoring stations as far away as Antarctica." That's a long way away. The shock wave, as I mentioned, the shock wave generated shattered glass and injured about 1,200 people. The Chelyabinsk meteor weighed about 1,100 metric tons when it raced undetected on its 18-second plunge to Earth's atmosphere. And it's just nearly impossible to estimate where these are going to come from. They're trying very hard, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But they just, bang, they're there, and they're gone, you know. And not always gone, because they leave some traces behind. We'll talk about that, too, briefly. It traveled about 41,000 miles per hour, which is nearly 60 times the speed of sound. Its shockwave was so powerful that it knocked some people to the ground. It also blew out windows and even window frames in thousands of buildings in the region of central Russia there, which was home to over 1 million people. When this meteor exploded in Earth's atmosphere, it glowed 30 times brighter than the sun and even sunburned some observers. These are all statistics. This is all fact here, what I'm telling you today. But it's important to note that it was a shockwave that produced these results. No one was killed since the atmosphere had pulverized this meteor and turned it 99% into dust. Isn't that amazing what this atmosphere does for us? I'm just amazed when you study science and history, science, you see what God has done, especially with the atmosphere above us. It's just amazing. Think about that. You know, in terms of the light generated from a falling meteor, astronomers use two definitions. I'm giving you a lot of scientific information today because the reason is I want everybody to understand these things. We should know them so that when the things that happen in the future happen, we're not going to be shocked. We're going to be aware that these things are going to take place. But anyway, there are two definitions astronomers use. A fireball is a meteor that burns brighter than the planet Venus, which is known as the morning or evening star. And that's pretty bright, if you've seen that. Also, a bolide is a meteor like the Chelyabinsk example that explodes in a bright flash of light in Earth's atmosphere, often with visible fragmentation. You can see it, like I showed you that picture there with the white, and that you can actually see some of that tearing up like it is doing that. Again, considering this example, Chelyabinsk, what scientists are concerned about and government officials around the globe are that asteroids that orbit the sun, what of them have an orbit that could hit the Earth? They're concerned about that. Astronomers call these near-Earth objects, NEOs. Bruce Bettis, chief scientist at the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, wrote the following on his website, and I quote here, using a cutoff for asteroid diameter of 1 meter, there are estimated to be more than 500 million near-Earth asteroids. For objects that cause major damage if they hit the Earth, larger than about 30 meters, there are about 1 million. So did you know that? I didn't know that, studied that. That's amazing, you would think, wow. On June 20th, 2018, the United States National Science and Technological Council released a report entitled The National Near-Earth Object Preparedness Strategy and Action Plan. Describing the threat from asteroids and meteors, the report in part stated this, NEOs, near-Earth objects, impacts of various size could have major environmental, economic, and geopolitical consequences detrimental to the United States, even if the impact is outside U.S. territory. Objects close to and larger than 1 kilometer can cause damage on a global scale. They can trigger earthquakes, tsunamis, and other secondary effects that extend far beyond the immediate impact area. The report also explains that NASA has identified all near-Earth objects, asteroids, large enough to cause significant global damage. And I think the number is around 17,000 right now they've identified, but there are a lot more that are out there. It also states that comets, talk about comets for a moment, from outside the solar system could impact Earth, again with very little warning. Regarding the nature of comets, senior writer Mike Wall at space.com wrote an article on December 13, 2016 entitled, Sounding the Alarm, Comets Pose a Threat to Earth Too. He says here, and I quote, a comet is relatively small celestial body consisting of ice, dust, and gas which moves around the sun at highly elliptical orbits. As a comet nears the sun, solar heat turns the ice into the nucleus into a gaseous haze. The tail of a comet usually consists of a straight gas tail and a curved dust tail called a comet. Comets are generally larger than asteroids, and Earth impacts are extremely rare, whereas the average asteroid could hit Earth at about 44,700 miles per hour. Comets hurl through space more than twice as fast. So, all this sounds distressing. I mean, you think about it. Again, in returning to the subject of meteorites, what are the odds of a person being actually killed by one? In fact, the probability of such an event is so low that it's almost non-existent. That's good news, right? Even though meteors enter Earth's atmosphere frequently, they actually go mostly unnoticed and cause virtually no damage. There is one that actually came in yesterday in India, and it impacted a farming village. And this, the meteor, it was the meteorite was about this size, I showed a picture of it on the internet yesterday. It buried itself 5 feet into the ground, and all these villagers were watching this thing. And they dug it out, and they showed a picture of a guy holding this yesterday. Just yesterday it happened. But most of the time, these things just go unnoticed. In February 15th, 2013, an article entitled "Odds of Death by Asteroid? Lower than a plane crash, higher than lightning." This is from Adam Mann, a reporter for Wired.com. And he wrote this. He said, "Most asteroids burn up in the atmosphere long before they hit the ground, and few that do will probably hit open ocean or a remote part of the Earth." And if you're careful, you watch, if you're interested in this, you can, there are websites you can go to that actually monitor where these asteroids, or these meteors are hitting. And I heard about just another one that happened a few weeks ago that landed in near Antarctica. And it was just totally unnoticed. I mean, NASA knew about it, but most people could care less about it, you know. Also, in an article entitled "What Are the Odds of a Meteorite Could Kill You?", Brian Clark, writing at NationalGeographic.com, stated this: "Putting a probability number on the chances of being hit by a space rock is difficult, since the events are so rare. Still, Tulane University Earth Science professor Stephen A. Nelson published a paper in 2014 that made the effort. He put the lifetime odds of dying from a local meteorite, asteroid, or comet impact at 1 in 1.6 million. So we're pretty safe there. You see the little cartoon there? I don't see it, I don't know if you can read it, but I'll tell you what it says. The teacher and her students in this classroom, and she says to her, little boy asks a question. She said, "No, Brian, an asteroid impact would never take us by surprise like it did the dinosaurs, because we're highly intelligent, and they were very stupid and dull-witted." Well, anyway, this comet, you know, 1.6 million would be compared to, here's some other odds. The odds of being killed in a car wreck is 1 in 90. It would be 250 to 1 for a fire, and 1 in 60,000 for a tornado, and 1 in 135,000 for a lightning strike. So your chances of being hit by a meteor is almost inconceivable. So that's great news, isn't it? Again, because such an occurrence is so unusual, the average person has no particular reason to know about it. They don't really care much anything about what's happening in space, since it doesn't affect their lives. But it will in the future, and we'll get to that. The only time they pay attention is when they hear or read about a large, bright meteor entering the atmosphere, such as the 2013 Chelyabinsk, Russia example, which according to NASA was the largest to occur on Earth in over 100 years. But when a meteor personally affects a person, he or she takes instant notice. I mean, what would you feel? One hand it landed in your backyard, you take instant notice. You tell all your friends and family members. For example, according to the UK Telegraph article, a man named Sergei Hamiltov, a resident there of Chelyabinsk, said this about a meteor that burst into his life. He said there was panic. People had no idea what was happening. We saw a big burst of light and then went outside to see what it was, and we heard a really loud thundering sound. So that event really got his attention, didn't it? So we can imagine what it's going to be like at the end of this age when great cosmic turbulence takes place uncharacteristically in the skies above. Think about that. Indeed, we shall, as we shall see, end-time Bible prophecy explains that this will indeed occur on an escalating scale. And as we shall also discover, it's God's intention to seize the attention of all of Earth's residents to help them understand something, how prideful they are, how idolatrous they are, how greedy they are, so they can repent of those sinful ways. God uses these for that purpose. So it's vital to note that God has employed supernatural, generated cosmic events, which are often described by Bible commentators as heavenly signs, at various times in biblical history. These include, for example, how he destroyed corrupt Sodom and Gomorrah through a massive barrage of fire and brimstone. Consider also one of the 10 plagues of Egypt before the Israelites' exodus, which included the 3 days of utter darkness. That gets your attention, doesn't it? Also, there was Joshua's long day and 3 hours of darkness that occurred at the time of Christ's crucifixion. But the most powerful supernaturally generated events are prophesied to occur during the intense period at the end of this age, just before, just prior to, and just after the time of Jesus Christ's return. During his earthly ministry, Jesus informed his disciples about key signs to expect leading up to his second coming. He told them that there would be a time of growing lawlessness in the world. There'd be turmoil, there'd be great distress. That's from Luke 21, verse 25 and 26. He said there would be a period of great religious deception and confusion. There would be wars that would be, and there would be distressing speculations about potential wars. And that's going to highly agitate and frighten people as well. Matthew 24, verse 4 says this: "Take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, saying, 'I am Christ,' and will deceive many. And you will hear of wars and rumors of war. See that you are not troubled." That same thing goes for what is ahead in the cosmos. Don't be troubled. "For all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. And there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows." So in that passage, Jesus gave a really critical overview of what is equivalent to the four horsemen of Revelation, also known as the first four seals of the biblical book that the prophet wrote, Revelation. Apostle John reinforces Christ's words with some additional detail. He says in Revelation 6, verse 8, "And the power was given to them," this is the four horsemen now he's speaking about, "over a fourth of the earth, to kill with sword, with hunger, with death, and by the beasts of the earth." Jesus further warns his disciples about a future heightened period of suffering and distress and terrible persecution. It's coming upon you and me as God's people. He labels that the Great Tribulation. The book of Revelation also describes this period as the fifth seal. It's also described as Satan's wrath. Matthew 24, verse 21, it says here, "For then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor shall ever be. Unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened." So you see how God cares for those who have repented and are obedient to him. He's watching out. He's carefully watching what's going on. He's not, as we heard in the song, God's watching over us. He keeps an eye on us continually. From where did the term seals arise, and how is it used? In a vision, the Apostle John saw that these seven seals had been affixed to a scroll which only Jesus Christ had the authority to remove. The seals are then detached from the scroll one by one, which gradually reveals the prophesied events that are going to occur. The first five seals describe conditions and great afflictions, including the persecution of God's people. God's going to allow us to go through some of that. But again, we're not to be concerned, not to be worried about it. Satan the devil is going to be on a rampage. He hates the church of God. It's going to happen. But God's intervention and judgment and the sixth and seventh seals are necessary and very just, considering all the horror that's going on in the world at that time. He's going to intercede because he's no longer going to tolerate Satan's deception, his criminality, and his persecution of his people, the saints. And he hates this interminable pattern of horrifying war that will be taking place at that time, which, if he didn't step in, it would be the extermination of all human life on the earth, and probably all life. Psalm 96, verse 13 says this, For he is coming to judge the earth. He shall judge the world with righteousness and the peoples with his truth. So in the book of Luke, we see how Jesus continues his prophecy, giving a brief overview of what will occur during the sixth and seventh seals, which again, here we go, this involves cosmic turbulence. Let's look at here in Luke chapter 21, verse 25. There will be signs in the sun and in the moon and in the stars, and on the earth distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring, men's hearts failing them from fear and the expectation of those things from which are coming on the earth. For the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And people, again, they don't even take any notice. But that what's ahead is going to be shake them to their foundation. Verse 27, then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. Now when those things begin to happen, look up and lift up your heads, because your redemption draws near. He's talking to you and me as members of his church. The phrase powers of the heavens will be shaken refers both to earth's atmosphere, again, and outer space, which is going to become extremely tempestuous at that time. To be sure, the physical prophesied events will not only be unprecedented in human experience, but they will far exceed normal standards, as we discussed earlier. Far exceed those. Unbelievable. Interestingly, though, since God's people will be aware of what is taking place due to the knowledge of these prophecies we're discussing, we'll cover next time too, and because of their close relationship to God, they will be at peace, believe it or not, because they know their redemption draws near. As the world is petrified to their socks, you know, with fear, trepidation, you and I will actually be cheering at that time. We will be so glad. We will have known that these things are happening because we studied them, we read them in the scriptures. So we will be at peace. We will be cheering because Christ is returning to the earth. He's going to stop the hellish trouble, the suffering that's occurring on the earth. He's coming to save humanity from total extinction, as I mentioned. And this is why we need to study and understand Bible prophecy, so that we can be extremely confident in our God and his promises when the world grows dark and dreadful and violent at that time. those days leading up to the time of Jesus Christ and our resurrection to eternal life. We need to know what the Bible tells us so that we can be at peace. So we shouldn't discount prophecy at all. That should be a great part of our Bible study. Let's move on to mention that since there are no celestial disturbances mentioned in the first five seals, let's go directly to the sixth seal now, which begins the coverage of these actions I've been telling you about. In doing so, we should again recall that it is God's great desire that people will turn to Him in repentance, and deep repentance, so they can obtain that protection that He affords them during those distressing times that lay ahead. And that's why it's so important that we preach the gospel, that we reach as many people now. This book of Revelation that's going to be in this ad, I mean, that's going to open people's eyes. Think about that. If they respond to that, those ads that way, to our website, our telecasts, and all these things, that's why we need to pedal to the metal. We can't let down in our efforts. Can't let that happen. So, the events that the Apostle John describes in the sixth seal serve as a punishment and also a very strong warning about even more staggering events that are going to take place during that fast approaching seventh seal, where God is going to level intense chastisements on disobedient, defiant humanity. Even so, what we find at Jesus, as Jesus opens the sixth seal, they are dramatic. Even though they're not as great as what's going to happen during the seventh seal, these still are very dramatic and troubling actions. Up until this point, some skeptics, you know, living in the future, they might try to explain away the dreadful results of the first five seals, saying, well, these are just, even though they're unprecedented, we've had these things before. We've had wars. We've had disease epidemics. We've had persecution. And that's just, they're just this temporary increase. I mean, it's gotten better, worse than it ever was, but it's just temporary. Oh, human history has always had these things. Those are going to be the excuses people say. And members of the Church of God are going to say, where is the promise of this coming? We don't want to be those people. However, at the opening of the sixth seal, that reasoning, okay, you got the first five seals and they put poo-poo that, but the opening of the sixth seal, it's going to be totally different. Any such reasoning that they had before is going to vanish away when they witness the unmistakable, unique scope of what is going to happen in the cosmos. Revelation 6, verse 12 says this, I looked and opened the sixth seal, and behold, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as a sackcloth of hair, and the moon became blood. So this is astonishingly intense, this vision that John sees, the darkened sun and moon. And this is his way of illustrating what can occur when large quantities of dirt and dust are thrown into the atmosphere, specifically after massive earthquakes and powerful volcanic eruptions. It continues, though, here in verse 13, and the stars of the heavens fell to earth as a fig tree drops its late figs when it is shaken by a mighty wind. Stars falling to earth, that's, we're talking about meteorites, asteroids. The whole sky is going to be just totally different than what people are used to. Again, using the terms of his day's agricultural-based society, John figuratively describes intense numbers of meteors that are plummeting wildly to the earth. It makes it seem as if the very stars have lost their moorings in the heavens. And next, we read about another amazing and unparalleled event occurring in space. Then the sky receded as a scroll when it is rolled up. And this will be the most really the most dramatic, the most frightening heavenly sign in the entire history of human civilization. The sky appears to literally open up so all people everywhere on earth will be able to see Jesus Christ coming from heaven to earth in awesome power and glory. And you can see how that happens. The earth opens up and the earth is turning, so all the people will see this image as the earth turns. Every person will be able to see it. Talk about frightening. Talk about unprecedented. Continue in verse 14. And every mountain and island was moved out of its place. God is really getting people's attention here, isn't he? So let's briefly note that in this passage, earth will be shaken intensely due to powerful earthquake activity. It already happened during the sixth seal, and the seventh seal is coming here. But unlike what will transpire during the seventh seal, in this instance here, in the sixth seal, the islands do not sink in the seas or under the seas, nor do the mountains collapse at that time. It's just going to shake them intensely. Wait till the seventh seal. The words John wrote are mirrored by those of the prophet Isaiah. Isaiah said in Isaiah 34, verse 4, all the host of heaven shall be dissolved. The host of heaven, the stars. And the heavens will be rolled up like a scroll. All their hosts shall fall down as the leaf falls from the vine, and as fruit falling from the fig tree. What happens as a result of all these unparalleled cosmic and other tumults of the sixth seal? Well, we're going to have to wait until part two to answer that question, and we're going to cover a lot more information, so be sure to come for that part two. Stay tuned for the next exciting episode, as they used to say on TV. Hope to see you then when we continue in part two of Cosmic Turbulence and End Time Bible Prophecy.